You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Thank you, Brendan. So welcome to our service of worship this morning, where we raise to worth the things that matter. My name is John Eaton, as you no doubt already know, a member of this church, and I welcome you here on behalf of the generations of Unitarians from South Australia and all over the world who've worshipped in this church for over 167 years now. Ours is a spiritual community, one that supports you in seeking and following your own spiritual path. Any path that encourages you to see more clearly, to love more abundantly, and to work toward a better world for all. I acknowledge that the land we meet on today is the land of the Kaurna people. Their traditional wisdoms show us how to better manage this ancient land. We acknowledge the Kaurna and their elders and the spiritual relationship that they and other Aboriginal people had with their land, one that extends back into prehistory, 60 to 80 millennia or even more, before any written history, but preserved in traditional art, folklore and in song lines. And we're just beginning to realise the cost of ignoring or dismissing these natural wisdoms. As we light this candle, let's reflect on who we are as Unitarians, as perhaps most of us, Universalists. What do we stand for? And I draw on the Unitarian Universalist website. We're Unitarians in our recognition of the oneness in us all. The things all people have in common far exceed our differences in culture or politics. We affirm and promote seven principles grounded in the humanistic teachings of the world's religions and validated by science, not ecclesiastical dogma designed to maintain and extend ecclesiastical power. We are Universalists in our recognition of the commonality of the wisdoms inherent in all major world religions, and we work for more justice and more love in our own lives, within our communities and in the wider world. Our spirituality is unbounded, drawing from scripture, science, nature and philosophy, personal experience and ancient traditions. This is who we are and what we stand for. It's now time for our children's story. So Helen's going to read that today, and we'll all benefit from it. It's a story for all ages.
We don't have any children, so you're it. The story today is called The Most Magnificent Thing. This is a regular girl and her best friend in the whole wide world. They do all kinds of things. They race, they eat, they explore, they relax. This one's all wet. This is the perfect thing to ward off demons.
I think it must have been a Canadian story. Thank you, Helen. It's now time for Kids Club, so you can choose. You can go out or you can stay here and listen to me. I hope you won't regret staying. So I hope you'll see the connection between that little story and what I'll talk about. We come now to candles of joy and concern. So I'll light the first. It's a tradition in this church to share significant events in our spiritual lives within an open forum of fellowship. So I invite you all to share briefly any recent significant event in your spiritual journey. Joys, sorrows, the insights, the milestones, etc. And to mark that event by lighting a candle. As some things lie too deep for words, we also invite you to light a candle in silence, or you may choose not to light a candle at all. And we can all widen the circle of compassion by listening with an open heart and mind. I now open our worship space for this sacred act which draws us together in our shared humanity. There are no further candles. I'll light one last candle. That's a candle for all those joys and concerns that remain silent in our hearts today, but no less deeply felt. For our meditation, I'll call it rumination. I'll draw on some of the insights of Rumi, and I'll leave these sayings or aphorisms on the screen, hopefully long enough for you to ruminate on a while, and Brendan will play some reflective music in the background. Thank you, Brendan. Thank you. Thank you, Brendan. The web abounds with roomy quotes. I'm not altogether sure what is lost in translation at times, but there are plenty of them there. So if you are yet to discover Rumi, go and search for them. We now come to the reading.
Today's reading, The Gentle Art of Ruminating. Some quotes from Rumi on unity. Rumi believed in oneness, the unity, the wholeness of all creation. In this sense, he is both a Unitarian and a Universalist. Rumi believed that to fully understand a concept, one must know its opposite. But it goes deeper than the binary implied by a concept and its opposite. One only fully understands the binary of opposites by understanding the nuances of meaning that span between these two extremes. Rumi, the 13th century Dervish poet, juxtaposes these opposites for creative and dramatic effect, just as a stone thrown into a calm, mirrored pond might ripple away the reflection. An understanding of unity must also consider the diversity to be celebrated, rather than be seen as reasons to divide. And an understanding of what divides us must also consider what we have in common, what we share. This sense of commonality and unity will rend the paper walls of words that divide us. For Rumi has written, quote, I am not from the East or West. I am not a Christian, Jew or Muslim. Nor am I Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi or Zen. I do not belong to any established religion or any cultural system. For the mystic lover who is intoxicated by the wine of mystical union with the beloved in his or her faith, Muslims, house of Allah, and Hindus, temple of idols are the same. I am neither the body nor the soul, for I belong to the divine soul of my Lord, my beloved. In God's world of unity, there is no place for separateness. Can't you see? Each of the many grapes harvested and separated from each other only by their single round skin. To become the Sultan's wine, they must first be removed from their skins by crushing them in a wine press. Only then are they united to become the Sultan's wine. The whole universe and all the people in it are as a single body, the one wholeness of creation. There is no servant or slave. All people are kin, and don't feel superior or self-righteous. We all are the servants of the same palace. And to those who enjoy finding faults in others, do not look down on anyone. God has a part for him, her, in everyone, regardless of nationality, class or religion. All people are mirrors in which God is reflected. We all come from eternity and are united in our longing for eternity. We are separated in this belief only by language.
Thank you, Jill. This morning I'd like to explore briefly with you the life and teachings of the 13th century Persian poet Jalal ad-Din Muhammad Bulk Rumi. It's a bit of a tongue twister, isn't it? It's such a challenging name, we generally just simplify it to Rumi, although it was unlikely that he was ever called by that name. In Persian, Jalal ad-Din means the glory of the faith. Rumi is what he's known to us now. It's an easily pronounced nisbah or surname. And all it means is that he was from the region of Rum in what is now Afghanistan. Balkh, or now Bactris, is another nisbah or surname, a place name reference to the town where he was born. And it's not unusual for Anglo-Saxon family names to also include the town of origin. Rumi is significant to me as a Unitarian because he was a Sufi universalist who embraced all the known religious traditions of the time. Zoroastrianism, the world's oldest monotheistic faith, the Abrahamic religions, Islam, I'm putting that first simply because that's what he was, a Sufi mystic, Judaism, Christianity, and as well as that, the religions of the East, Hinduism and Buddhism, which were making their impact on the area. So in order to put Rumi's writing and poetry into context, let's understand a little of his known history. Rumi was born on the 30th of September 1207, most likely in the town of Balkh, because that's the nisbah of his name. The superpower of the era was the Persian Empire, a monarchy much larger than it is today. It included all of today's Iran, Afghanistan, parts of Pakistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkey, and Iraq. Turkey had not yet been formed as a nation, of course, and Afghanistan was part of the Khorasan province in the old Persian Empire, a name that still echoes with us as a result of that long 12-year war in Afghanistan. Three countries now claim him as their national poet: Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan. This is Balkh today, picture on the left, Bactris as it's called. Probably hasn't changed all that much, except for the name. Bactria is where the two humped camel came from, otherwise called the Mongolian camel. In Balkh, there are signs of former glory with these eroded mosaics on these two holy places in Balkh, built two or three centuries after Rumi, but now faded by war and neglect. Let's talk a little bit about the family he was born into. The Muslim families of the 13th century Balkh were, particularly the well-to-do ones, were patriarchal. So while the most important figure of his early childhood was undoubtedly his mother, the really important figure in directing his career was Rumi's father, Baha ad-Din Walad. It's a bit of a tongue twister, so we'll call him Baha, the childhood name that Rumi called him. Baha was a renowned theologian in his own right. He was also a jurist, a noted Sufi mystic, author, and teacher. It's a story that is still a familiar occurrence in this region and globally, and it unfolds like this. When Rumi was 7, Baha was advised to leave Balkh just before the Mongol 13th century invasion of Afghanistan. So sometime between 1215 and 1220, their sizable entourage, Rumi's family, all their servants, and Baha's disciples, the father's disciples, fled westward on a hiraj, or hijra, which describes a forced migration by refugees. Hijra is now used to describe the pilgrimage, usually to Mecca, made by devout Muslims to commemorate the Prophet Muhammad's journey in 622 of the current era, from Mecca to Medina. You'll remember that. He was also a refugee escaping persecution. So as 622 CE, current era, celebrates the birth of Islam, next year, 2022, will celebrate Islam's 1400th year as a religion. The family finally settled for 11 years in the town of Karaman in Anatolia, now south central Turkey. After 11 years in Karaman, Rumi was now an 18-year-old, old enough to get married. So he married Gawa Khatun in 1225. They had one son in Karaman, Sultan Walad, and another, Aluddin Shalabi, born later in Konya, Anatolia, about 100 kilometres north of Karaman. After Rumi's father was called there to become a head of a madrasa, a religious school. That's not too different from our own situation, where in this era we had certainly the time of the monasteries, and if you wanted an education, if you wanted to learn to read and write, you had to join the church, or become a priest, in fact. Rumi was now 25. He'd been married to Golwa for 7 years when she suddenly died in childbirth. And Rumi remarried a widow, Kera Khatun, in Konya. They had 2 children, a son, Amir Alim Shalabi, and a daughter, Malika Khatun. Kera already had a 12-year-old daughter named Kimia Khatun from her first marriage, and Aluddin, Rumi's youngest son, from his first marriage to Gawa, had one day hoped to marry her. So there's an intrigue. Rumi's father, Baha, was to occupy the position there for 7 years before he died, and Rumi then succeeded his father as the Maulvi of the Kolvi Madrasa in Konya. 10 years later, in Konya, by now he was 35, his public life really took off. He became a fakir with important civic and religious duties to perform. He had to become an expert in Islamic law, a guardian of the community and its religion, with all the authority to issue fatwas, or Islamic religious rulings, and to give sermons in the mosque. He was a trustee of property for widows, orphans, and charitable trusts, and a marriage guardian for widows, with the authority to arrange marriages. So he must have felt pretty entitled. Now the plot thickens. He now found himself in a very esteemed position within his community at Konya. However, Rumi was always the restless romantic. He felt the need to shape his own image rather than just assume the somewhat conservative mantle of his father. His real education in humanity was about to begin in earnest. Rumi, the privileged teacher or Maulvi and Islamic judge, needed to soften a little. And in 1244, when by now he was 37, along came just the catalyst he needed. It came in the form of a rather wild dervish by the name of Shams Tabrizi. We'll call him Shams. He came with the nickname The Bird because he couldn't stay very long in one place. He flitted about so much that the rumour has it that he had the power to be in 2 places at once. Shams was 30 or more years older than the 37-year-old Rumi. So what about this somewhat Rasputinish Shams? Well, the most reliable picture I think we've got of him is on the shrine to Shams in Koy, in northern Iran, about 1,000 kilometres further east of Konya in central southwest Turkey. As the story goes, even before the two had met, Shams had travelled throughout the Middle East, searching and praying for someone who could endure his company. A voice said to him, "And what will you give in return?" Shams replied, as it turned out prophetically, "My head, my head." The voice then said, "The one you seek is Jalaluddin Rumi of Konya." Shams was just the spark needed to ignite Rumi's poetic imagination. The dervish teacher and Rumi, his somewhat conservative student, became soulmates for as little as 40 days, some historians say for as long as 2 years. Some of Shams' dervishness inevitably rubbed off Shams, transforming Rumi into an ascetic and a dervish romantic. Rumi wasn't entirely about to relinquish his position and become a free spirit. His privileges were built on it. He was a realist. But it was Shams who can be credited with turning Rumi into the romantic that we know him to be today. So why was my head, the price of Rumi's friendship and company, so prophetic? Well, it all ended badly for Shams, who suddenly disappeared. Some say Shams, alias the bird, had simply flown the nest, flown to another town. So the story goes, though, Rumi, in what was not one of his wisest decisions, had arranged a marriage between Shams, approaching 70, 66 or 67, and his stepdaughter from his second marriage, Kimia Khatun, aged 12. But not a rare event in 13th century Persia, Turkey. By now the patriarch, Rumi, saw Shams' marriage with Kimia as Shams' reward for his teaching and friendship, blind to its effect on his son and his stepdaughter Kimia, who had secretly planned to marry each other. However, such a blatantly forced marriage seems to fly in the face of much of the romance in Rumi's poetry. Was he practicing what he preached? One assumes it was either a failure to consult or coercion. It seems somewhat out of character with the Rumi that we thought, that I thought, I'd got to know through the writing. Perhaps his fame had inflated his ego and sense of infallibility. Perhaps it had ignited his sense of entitlement. Also, the communication between Rumi and his youngest son, Alauddin, couldn't have been all that clear either. Look, Dad, this is what's going to happen if you do this. No, it didn't come to that. Tragically, Kimia died soon after being forced to marry Shams instead of her stepbrother, Alauddin. Shams then suddenly disappeared, and there was the whiff of conspiracy in the Konya air. It was rumoured that Shams had been murdered by Alauddin, an honour killing carried out by two accomplices. That was the rumour. No Vera to actually start the investigation and ferret through all the evidence, go up several blind alleys and then come to a conclusion. If there were ever there was formulaic TV, that's it. Rumi preferred to believe that he had simply been deserted by his teacher, alias the bird. Shams had flown the nest to somewhere else. Rumi fell into a deep state of grief after Shams' disappearance, and he spent the next 2 years searching, ultimately becoming resigned to Shams' disappearance. He realised that any future searching would be futile, that Shams had gone from his life forever, and for whatever reason. He rationalised his loss in verse thus, "Why should I seek? I am the same as he. His essence speaks through me. I have been looking for myself." Rumi believed that Shams' wild dervish spirit had somehow been spiritually absorbed within his own. After Shams' disappearance, there followed a creative outpouring from Rumi of thousands of poems during the last 25 years of his life. Over 70,000 verses of poetry collected in two epic books, the Divan of Shams al-Tabrizi and Masnavi, were the two books that I've shown you there. They're still available, still on display. The Divan of Shams al-Tabrizi, his earlier work, consisted of poems and ruminations deeply philosophical and mystical, interspersed with poems of fiery, soulful expression, passionate love verses filled with yearning and desire. Masnavi, his second volume, is full of anecdotes, life lessons, moral stories, and significantly stories drawn from all three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Contemporary and popular topics of the day, and satirical tales. Both books have an all-embracing universality about them, we've read from them today. Masnavi is a call from Rumi's independent soul, yearning for true freedom from dogma and hypocrisy. Written by Rumi in 1262 AD, its English title is Spiritual Couplets. It's thought to be the longest single-authored mystical poem ever written. As the spiritual masterpiece within the Persian Sufi tradition, it teaches how to progress to the ultimate goal of the Sufi path, union with God. In it, he writes about the abolishment of the established fear-based religions. For him, fear-based religion is poison, and his remedy is a love-based doctrine, a life journey free of guilt, fear, and shame. Now, where have we heard that before? So, in retrospect, Rumi, though flawed, is neither exclusively a Sufi, Hindu, Jew, nor Christian. He drew from them all. He was a Sufi universalist. Both the Divan and the Masnavi transcend religion and dogma. They speak of a state of enlightened, universal humanity, free from Kant and cultural and ecclesiastical myopia. They've been translated into many of the world's languages. Rumi died on December the 17th, 1273, aged 66. He'd been a devout Muslim all his life, praying five times a day and keeping all the required fasts. But in the end, he wrote about belief in a religion of love, one that ignored all the dogma, usually all the unbelievable bits. In the Masnavi, he wrote, "The religion of love is beyond all faiths. The only religion for lovers is God, and God is love. It's a doctrine that rests uneasily with the circumstances leading to Sham's disappearance, for whatever reason." Rumi had previously given his followers special instructions to treat the night of his own death like they would a joyous wedding night. The mystic had planned his own funeral, complete with singers, musicians, dancers, Quran reciters, and imams. For Rumi, the presence of the singers and dancers indicated that the deceased was both a Muslim and a lover. But there were also Jewish rabbis reciting psalms, Christian priests reading from the Gospels, which left some of his Muslim followers somewhat bewildered. They hadn't quite realised how much Rumi had become the well-respected figure within other religious communities. So Rumi points the way ahead for us all. Whenever political differences exaggerate the differences between religions, and that's what happens, isn't it? I would place him in history as a definitive universalist, 8 centuries ahead of the time it's taken us to articulate our idea of universalism. Certainly a universalist by reputation, perhaps even a Unitarian universalist, if Unitarian now means not a reaction from the Trinity, but unity or oneness, which is how we should regard that label nowadays. One that binds us into a common, shared understanding of the divinity inherent in all of us, the living presence of God in the world, and especially when it finds expression in love. Universalists will find philosophical kinship with Rumi, the poet from Rum, and there is a growing awareness that we share Rumi with all those spiritually aware and independent thinkers from all religious traditions or none, who are exploring their own spiritual paths and the spark of divinity that lies within us all. Rumi, the universalist poet, helps to light our way. If you haven't already done so, I'd encourage you to explore some more of Rumi's insights into the peaks and troughs of life, into our flawed humanity. And by then he probably realised he was no saint himself. And it is within the power of each and every one of us to recognise and to draw out the divinity within ourselves and within others, despite these flaws and fallibilities. And isn't this our never-ending journey? Let's call it an adventure. As Tennyson said of Odysseus, alias the Latin Ulysses, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. It's an odyssey that we need not, should not make alone. It's a shared journey, a reciprocal one, towards discovering the shared divinity within us all. And by that I mean that you, with your unique understandings and insights, can help bring out the best in me, as I might help to bring out the best in you. So let's continue our journey within our loving communities, including this one, supporting each other along the way. Bon voyage. For our closing words, I'll let Rumi have the last say. It comes in the form of a poem, The Guest House. It's all about the opposites of darkness and life, the texture of life, that we know one by the other. It's all about acceptance, self-acceptance, other acceptance, life acceptance. To accept that to be fully human, we need to allow ourselves to see and experience both the darkness and the light within ourselves. And in our darkest moments, to see the glimmer of light, the hope of a better us, lighting the way ahead. Listen to what we have to say to ourselves. Give ourselves the opportunity to become more aware of every moment of the day. Then we'll see our journeys unfold into lives worth living. So we come to the guest house. The Guest House by Rumi. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival comes in the form of a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honourably. The guest may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Amen.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians. Thank you.